This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's NOMIS, to apply today. This episode is sponsored in part by PNAS's Science Sessions podcast. Today, take 5 minutes and learn something new about the physical, social, and natural worlds from the frontiers of science. Subscribe to Science Sessions on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to the Science Podcast for August 16th, 2019. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, we start with staff writer Gretchen Vogel. She talks with me about all the technologies from MRI to CRISPR being used to determine the sex of chicken eggs. And I talk with Melanie Bergman about finding microplastics in snow all the way up in the Alps, even in Arctic ice floes. Now we have staff writer Gretchen Vogel. She's going to talk to us about ethical eggs. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi.
Okay. What is an ethical egg? I feel like my mind went in so many directions when I first heard this term, and I just wasn't sure. So
there are several different kinds of ways you can make eggs more ethical. But in this case, we're talking about the problem that the egg industry has with male chicks. It turns out that male chicks are of no use. They can't lay eggs. And because chickens that lay eggs, the layers, have been bred to be super specialized for putting all of their energy into laying eggs, their brothers don't put on meat fast enough to be marketable for their meat. So hatcheries sort chicks when they hatch by hand. There are workers called chick sexers. They sort the males from the females, and the females go to farms to grow up and be layers, and the males are killed, either by gassing or by putting them into a shredder. This is not a particularly appetizing aspect of egg production. And so animal rights groups and animal welfare groups and consumers and governments and even the egg industry would all like to find a way to end the practice.
This idea has been around for a long time. The idea that it just doesn't seem like a good idea to have all these eggs, wait till they hatch, and then half of them you have to basically get rid of the animal. Why has it been so hard to sex a chicken egg as opposed to a chick?
Yeah, it seems like it should be a pretty easy thing to solve, but it turns out that there's lots of ideas where it works in the lab, and getting it to actually work on a hatchery floor at the scale that hatcheries currently work at is a technical challenge. So hatcheries, the large ones, process 50,000 eggs an hour. And
wow.
That's a challenge for the testing methods that have been developed so far. But scientists have a lot of ideas and they're getting closer. And there are some cull-free eggs or kill-free eggs on grocery store shelves in Berlin, where I live. I have a few in my refrigerator right now.
Mm-hmm. Those rely on a technology that involves lasers and robots.
Correct.
Just to upsell it.
Exactly.
Here. Can you describe how that process?
Yeah, it's based on actually a hormone test. So female chicken embryos produce a hormone that's related to estrogen, and they produce it in enough quantity to be detected at about day 9 of development. An egg usually takes 21 or 22 days to hatch, so not quite halfway through development. And a company in Germany called Select has developed a robot machine that uses a laser to poke a tiny, tiny hole in the eggshell and then suck out a tiny, tiny bit of the embryonic fluid that surrounds the embryo. They can use that drop of fluid to test for the presence of the hormone. And if the hormone is there, the eggs are sent back to the incubator to continue to develop. And if it's not, the eggs are either unfertilized or they're male. And they're then frozen and pulverized and used for protein, for egg powder that can be added to animal feed or can go to other industrial uses.
We talked earlier about how many eggs get processed in a hatchery per hour. How much can this robot handle right now?
Right now, it handles about 3,000 eggs an hour, which is enough for small hatcheries, but they're trying to scale up. They're also trying to move the test a bit earlier in development because some animal welfare groups say that by day 9, there's a chance that chicks could already feel pain. Their central nervous system has just started to develop. That's a point of debate, but most people agree that earlier in development would be better. You save more money. You don't have to incubate the male eggs for as long.
Other companies are trying to do this earlier, as you mentioned. They're trying to do it faster and cheaper. And one of them is even relying on a method that doesn't poke a hole in the egg. Can you talk about that one?
Yes, there's a company that is trying to capture some of the volatile molecules that leak through an eggshell, starting as soon as the egg is laid. And there are other researchers who have found that you can actually determine an egg's sex based on the differences in these molecules. It's not quite ready for prime time yet, in part because they're trying to do it before the eggs even enter the incubator, within the first 36 hours of the egg being laid. And that means that they have to do it at refrigerator temperatures that the FDA requires eggs to be kept at before they enter the incubator. And that's proving a bit of a technical challenge, but they're still working on it.
Okay. What about this group that's looking to gene edit the chickens so that one of the egg sexes glows?
There's actually a couple of groups that are trying this. Groups in Israel and Australia are pursuing the technology. They use CRISPR to add a gene to one of the chicken's sex chromosomes. It turns out that birds have kind of the opposite set of sex chromosomes from mammals. Mammals have X and Y chromosomes. Females are XX, males are XY. But in birds, males are ZZ and females have a W and a Z chromosome. So they put a fluorescent marker on the Z chromosome of a female layer. And then they mate that bird with a regular male. And all of the males that result from that mating carry ZZs, carry the marker gene from their mother's Z chromosome.
Right.
The females don't carry any marker. They're just regular WZ.
They get a W from mom and a Z from dad, and dad doesn't have the edit.
Exactly. Then you can put the eggs under a fluorescent light and the male ones glow. That enables you to sort them out and send them off to other uses where the unmarked eggs can go on and develop and become regular laying hens that don't have any edited genes. And their eggs that they lay also don't have any edited genes. The scientists who are working on this are optimistic that they'll be able to use the technology without having to go through all the hoops that a genetically modified organism would normally have to go through, since the end product isn't actually genetically modified. It's not clear that that's really going to be the case, but they're optimistic that that argument will help to persuade both consumers and regulators that this is a good way to go.
So we've talked about sampling the fluid and looking for hormones. We've talked about smelling volatiles coming off the eggs. And now we've talked about gene editing to make one egg glow and not the other. Are there any other techniques that people are trying to sex eggs very early in their development?
There's a whole bunch. Yeah, some teams are trying to use MRI to look at the embryo. There are teams that are trying to use machine learning to quantify some of the subtle shape and size differences in male and female eggs, although it's not clear that that'll ever quite be accurate enough, but some people are trying. And there's another group that's using spectroscopy to analyze eggs at day 4 after laying, where they cut a hole in the eggshell that's about a little more than a centimeter wide, and then they shine a laser light on a blood vessel. And the difference in the reflected spectrum from that laser can tell them whether the embryo is a male or female. That is another technique that's close to being implemented in a hatchery in Germany, but isn't quite there yet.
Wow. You bought some of these ethical eggs here in Berlin, in Germany. Is this something that is a global concern and the approach will most likely be rolled out much more broadly than in Europe?
Yeah, it is a concern. I think the first public awareness kind of came from Europe and especially from Germany, from animal welfare groups here, and they've been pushing for a long time for a solution. And the German government has taken it very seriously and has given a fair amount of funding to try and find a solution. And in fact, the current government has promised in its coalition agreement to end the practice sometime within its 4-year term. German lawmakers are actually considering banning the practice, although scientists I talk to hope that doesn't happen. But welfare groups in the US are also pushing for a solution. And the United Egg Producers in the US has said that they want to end the practice by next year. They said that in 2016. Whether 2020 will really work is still up in the air. But the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, is also offering a prize, a $6 million prize for a solution to this problem. And they said they got 21 entries from 10 countries for their initial round of seed funding. And they'll make some of their first awards next month.
This seems like a lot of people are working on this from very different angles. Is that surprising to you?
One thing that's kind of cool about this story is that everybody's on the same page. Everybody would like to solve this problem. As one of my sources said, it's not a problem that needs social change to solve. The right technology can take care of it. And everybody's motivated to find a technology that'll work. So most people involved are optimistic that the final hurdles will finally be overcome. And soon there will be no more culling of male chicks.
Thanks, Gretchen.
Thank you, Sarah.
Gretchen Vogel is a staff writer for Science. You can find a link to her story at sciencemag.org/podcasts. Stay tuned for an interview with Melanie Bergman about microplastic contamination in ice flows and alpine slopes. This episode is brought to you in part by PNAS's Science Sessions podcast. Science Sessions are short, 5-minute conversations with brilliant scientific minds. In less time than it takes to drink a cup of coffee, you can explore new worlds, discover big ideas, and learn something new. Subscribe to Science Sessions on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. This week's episode is also brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Everyone knows the risks of driving drunk. You could get in a crash, people get hurt or killed. But there are some surprising numbers out there. Almost 29 people in the United States still die every day in alcohol-impaired vehicle crashes. That's one person every 50 minutes. And even though drunk driving fatalities have fallen by a third in the last 3 decades, drunk driving still claims more than 10,000 lives each year. Many people are unaware, though, that driving while on drugs can also be very dangerous. In 2015, 42% of drivers killed in crashes tested positive for drugs. And from 2007 to 2015, marijuana use among drivers killed in crashes doubled. So please don't drive when you're impaired. If you're impaired from alcohol or drugs, don't get behind the wheel. If you feel different, you drive different. Get high, get a DUI. Drive sober or get pulled over. We've all heard about plastic contamination in the ocean, but now researchers writing this week in Science Advances have measured microplastic concentrations in snow from Arctic ice and the Swiss Alps. Melanie Bergman is here to talk to us about it. Hi, Melanie.
Hello.
You were trying to find evidence of plastic contamination in remote locations and locations near a city. Where did you get your samples exactly?
We targeted the Fram Strait area, which is the strait between Greenland and Svalbard, because this is where we do our ocean observation work and where we found a lot of microplastics in the sea ice and in the deep sea sediments. Then we took samples on Svalbard in the Bavarian and Swiss Alps and also in northern Germany on the Isle of Helgoland, which is on the North Sea, and in the city of Bremen.
How did you take these samples? You wanted to measure specifically plastic particles in snow, right?
Yeah. So we went out by helicopter most of the time and flew to distant ice floes. And some ice floes were also visited by dinghies.
That's in the Arctic. And how about in the Swiss Alps and urban areas?
In the Swiss Alps, basically, people just wandered off, took their spoon and just put it into glass containers. In Helgoland, it was pretty much the same as well as in Bremen.
The point here was to look at how the levels varied between more isolated regions and more urban regions. What were those levels? How are they different?
The highest levels that we found were in Europe, which is not unexpected because they were much closer to urban areas. The highest amount we found in the Bavarian Alps, more than 150,000 particles per liter. This really is a lot. If you compare that with the Arctic samples, those had a lot less microplastics in them. But still, the third highest amount that we found was actually from an ice floe. Mm-hmm. So there's still a reason for concern, of course.
You mentioned that these are microplastics. How is that defined?
Microplastics are basically particles smaller than 5 millimeters, but this is quite large. Most of the particles that we found were really, really small. Roughly 6 of the diameter of a human hair. So really, really tiny particles that you cannot see by eye.
Let's go back to the ocean for a second here. This is something you and I have both brought up as something that we know there's plastic contamination in the ocean. What are these levels that you saw in the snow in these different regions? How do those levels compare with what's seen in the ocean?
The levels in snow are actually quite comparable with what we found. For instance, sea ice, if you take the mean of Arctic ice flow snow, we found around 1,800 particles per liter. This compares with around 4,500 particles in sea ice. In the deep sea sediments, it's similar to, it's around 2,000 particles per liter. So these levels are fairly comparable.
I guess I can imagine how plastic might end up in the ocean, but what's the mechanism? How are they getting where they are?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That was kind of unexpected question for us too, because we never expected to find so many particles. Mm-hmm. What we think is that because we found a lot of varnish in our particles, and if you start thinking of it, a lot of the surfaces of everyday objects that we use are nowadays covered in varnish, which contain polymers. Cars, offshore platforms, the facades of houses are often covered with polymer varnish, and also on ships, of course. We also know that this is worn off with time. That's why we have to renew it. This is because the wind is constantly blowing against it and wearing it off, and it never goes really away. Mm-hmm. And then probably ends up in the air. We know that particles which are similar in size, for instance, dust from the Sahara or also some pollen from willow trees or pine trees, can travel very long distances, more than 3,000 kilometers. And this is roughly also the distance of the main wind direction to our sampling area. So it's reasonable to believe that we're actually contributing our part to this. But there's also wind coming from other directions.
Can you trace these plastics, these microplastics that you're seeing, back to their source?
Well, we cannot trace back these microplastics to the exact source. Unfortunately, that's still quite difficult because even if you know something is varnish or rubber, we can only tell it's rubber. We cannot say if it comes from a car or from some other structures. But what we can draw on is knowledge about the pathway of other contaminants, for example, mercury, which we find a lot of in the Arctic Ocean as well. Other researchers have done some work and found that the majority of mercury is transported into the Arctic Ocean by snow. Mm-hmm. And also comes from the Northern Europe, from Europe, basically.
Okay. Well, have measurements like you did with snow, have measurements like that been done with the air, looking for airborne plastic?
Yeah, this has been investigated for the air from Paris, in the vicinity of Paris, also in Dongguan, which is a Chinese city. There's also been research done in India, but this was mainly on dust, but nevertheless, that mostly comes also out of the air, of course. And recently, there's also been a paper about microplastics in the Pyrenees, another mountain region in Europe.
What are the levels like from those?
The levels seem to be lower, though you have to say that the studies are not strictly comparable.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the French studies, which were carried out in the vicinity of Paris, looked mostly at fibers. And we didn't include these fibers in our particle numbers because we cannot tell how much of these fibers were actually microplastics.
Yeah.
We can only see, they're fibers and some proportion may be microplastics, but we don't know that. So basically, there's a big methodological difference. But even though we found much higher particle numbers. So, yeah. And also, we looked at snow and not at air.
Mm-hmm.
And snow seems to be a very efficient scavenger, not only for microplastics, of course, but generally speaking, for particles in the air. The work that we report always produces higher numbers of microplastics because we use a method where we scan all the particles that we find, which is on a filter.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of other studies look at a sample under a microscope, pick out what looks like plastic, and then run these also through a Fourier transform infrared spectrometer to confirm that these are plastics and what plastics they are. But there may be particles which they didn't see because they're too small, or they just are not so colored or whatever, then they overlook these. And that's why we always have very high numbers in comparison with other studies.
Mm-hmm. You also have a lower bound, though. There's, you know, a certain cutoff point for how small you can detect as well.
Yeah, of course we do. It's 11 micrometers at the moment. And it's pretty clear that the vast majority of particles that we found were in the very smallest size range where we could still detect particles. So this gives me reason to believe that there are even more particles in the yet smaller size fraction that we currently cannot detect.
Let's talk about the implications of this. Are there health concerns, environmental concerns associated with having a bunch of microplastics all over the snow?
There's a lot of research going on about the effects of microplastics,
mm-hmm.
but it's largely directed towards animals.
Right.
It's very strange that despite this huge research effort at the moment, there are no results so far about the effects of microplastics on human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really strange.
Are there environmental concerns about this plastic being in the snow?
Yes, because that's an additional route of transport to the north, to the ocean, to Earth's surfaces as such. Because we didn't only find it on an ocean surface, but also on Earth surfaces. And here it could also contaminate agricultural land. And if you think of microplastics being in snow, that means that it has to be in the air, first of all. It means it's everywhere.
Thank you so much, Melanie.
Okay, great.
Melanie Bergman is a marine biologist at the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research in Bremerhaven, Germany. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, many other places, or you can listen on the Science website. That's sciencemag.org/podcast. There you'll also find links to the research and news discussed in the episode. To place an ad on the podcast, contact midroll.com. The show was produced by Sarah Crespi and edited by Podigy. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.